It's sorry. It's January 13th, 2009, and I'm sitting with John Knight in Gainesville, Florida. John, I was wondering if you could tell me when and where you were born.
I was born in Orlando, Florida, May 1st, 1925.
And how many brothers and sisters did
I
you
had
have?
one brother and one sister. They were both younger than I am.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a comptroller of a Lewis Candy and Tobacco Company, which was a competitor of Eli Whitt in Orlando and several other cities. There was a branch office here in Gainesville. So I would come up with him sometimes and became somewhat familiar with Gainesville. My sister majored in organ performance and still performs in church in Birmingham, Alabama. My brother is a minister in North Miami. Every time he resigns, he's called on to be pastor of another church.
Were you married before? Oh, sorry. Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to Orlando High School for high school. Orlando had 3 years of junior high and then 3 years of senior high. And the senior high was Orlando High School, which is no longer in existence because Orlando High split up into two different schools, Cherokee Junior High. Boone, no, I'm sorry, split up into Boone High and Edgewater High, which are still in existence. The building where Orlando High School was is still standing, but it's now a middle school, Howard Middle School. I went to my 50th reunion, and we were allowed to tour the old building. We were allowed to see if we could find our lockers and classrooms, and I couldn't find any of those things. The only two places that were familiar to me was the principal's office, and everybody laughs about that, and then the auditorium. I was familiar with the auditorium because I had performed on the stage a couple of times, and I was familiar with the principal's office because the principal, W.R. Boone, organized high school ROTC. It was not authentic, but he had served in the reserve, and I think he was a captain in the reserve. And I was a platoon sergeant, I think a company clerk. And I took the roll, and I would have to go to the principal's office to turn in the roll call. So that's why I was familiar with that.
Were you married before the beginning of the war?
No.
No.
No, I didn't meet my wife until after I was out of college.
Can you compare your attitudes before and after Pearl Harbor?
Well, my attitude was that I was just all of a sudden, I realized we were at war. Just sort of a blow. That's when I can get into my story. When I graduated from high school, all of us boys knew that we were going into service one way or another. If we didn't enlist, then we would be drafted. And we felt like the worst thing that could happen to us was to be drafted. That would be a sure thing to go into the infantry, and we wanted to try to get into something better than that. And I volunteered for Army Air Corps cadet school, and really thought I would like that, and I passed the written exam, which required a pretty high grade before you could qualify, and I passed that fine. Then I went down for the physical, and everything was going along fine until I got to the end of the line, and they lined us, all our candidates, lined us candidates up on against the wall, and this medical officer took a last look at us, and he started at my head and looked down to my feet and saw my flat feet, so he immediately disqualified me. And I've never been able to figure out why you couldn't be a pilot with flat feet. But anyhow, that was the end of my participation there. Other possibilities I explored, the Navy had what they called a V-5 program, where you could get into naval aviation, or you could elect to go into the Marines. And both of these possibilities meant you would take some basic training, and they would send you to school, and you'd wind up as a commissioned officer in the Navy or the Marines. I had a cousin who was a year older than me, and he'd already been accepted and wound up with a commission in the Marines. But they were filled up. Those possibilities were filled up. So I found out that the Army had a similar program, the Army Specialized Training Program. And so I applied for that, and we had a written exam. We had to make a high enough score to qualify for that, and we were supposed to take infantry training, and of course I passed all the requirements, and we were supposed to take infantry training, and then be sent to college at the government expense. They would train us in engineering or even medicine, but medicine was closed. The only thing open was engineering, so I selected that. And then I went on into basic. I was supposed to present this card when I was drafted. So when I was drafted, I was inducted at Camp Blanding and had a physical, medical doctor looked at my feet and said, well, I don't think you, we don't have to accept you. And I said, well, I'm going into this Army Specialized Training Program, and they're going to send me to college. And he said, well, I'll just put you down as accepted. So I went in, and then I was sent to Fort Benning for my basic infantry training. We were supposed to have 15 weeks of basic training and then go to college and then go to OCS and become commissioned officers in the Army. Well, about halfway through the basic training, they lined us up on the side of a hill for an important announcement, and they told us that the program had been closed and we were all going to be sent to the infantry divisions. So we went on and had, we were supposed to have 15 weeks of basic training, but they cut it short, about 13, and I was sent to Camp Livingston, Louisiana, which is near Alexandria. And I wound up in the 86th Infantry Division, Black Hawk Division. Well, the non-commissioned officers there were old, career non-coms, and they said, oh, we got a bunch of college boys here. They don't know anything about training. They haven't had enough basic training, so they decided we needed more training, so they really worked us to death. They gave us some of the most rigorous training that I guess anybody could ever have. But it was not a whole lot more rigorous than what we'd already had at Fort Benning. I remember one of the big times of the basic training at Fort Benning was we were supposed to go out on a 2-week bivouac and supposed to stay out there 2 weeks. And when we marched out to the location about 12 miles with full field packs on, and then we pitched tents, two-man tents, and it was freezing cold and started to rain, about like it is here, but a lot colder. And it was, we were supposed to act as if we were under combat conditions, so we couldn't have any lights or fires or anything. Well, the weather was so bad until the commanding officer waived the rule and allowed us to build fires to dry our clothes out. But we dug foxholes and we spent the night on the ground in two-man tents. And I knew we were going to have this bivouac, and I wrote home to my parents. See, I was single. I was only 18 years old when I was drafted. And my parents sent me something, I can't remember the name of it, but it looked like sort of a jelly. You could strike a match to it and it would set off heat. I can't think of the name of that stuff. Maybe you can.
Sterno?
Sterno, that's what it was. Yeah. They sent me a couple of jars of that Sterno. And so I showed it to the fellow I had pitched my tent with. See, each soldier had a half of a pup tent, we call it. And we'd put those two halves together, see, to make one tent. And then he and I would settle down on the ground with blankets and so forth. So I showed him this Sterno, and we struck a match to it. And the space inside the tent was so small, it just heated up the whole tent in a hurry. And the funny thing about it, the outside of the tent was wet from the rain, so the heat began to cause the water on the tent to become steam. So all the other men saw all the steam rising from the tent and came running over to see what was wrong. Well, anyhow, nobody ever said anything about us not using it, so we used it. Well, anyhow, that was just describing some of the rigorous training we went through. Of course, we went through all sorts of other required infantry training, bayonet assault courses and obstacle course. The commanding officer always said, "All right, men, we're going to go out and run the obstacle course." He called it the obstacle course. Well, anyhow, I wound up in Camp Livingston with the 86th Infantry Division and went through rigorous training all over again. Well, I began to have a little bit of trouble with my feet while I was still at Fort Benning, and they sent me to an orthopedic surgeon, and he fitted some arch supports, and they were fitted wrong or something. I don't know what was the matter, but they didn't seem to help me any. And I didn't seem to be having a whole lot of trouble, but I had just found out, you know, that I was going to wind up in the infantry. And so, to tell you the truth, I made out a little bit like I was having trouble with my feet, thinking maybe they'd discharge me and send me home. But no, they didn't do any such thing as that. And so I wound up at, I received a pass at Christmas time. We were there at Fort Benning at Christmas time, and my grandfather had a farm at Dothan, Alabama, which was about 100 miles away from Fort Benning, and my mother and father are going to be there for Christmas. So I applied for a pass and received a pass to be gone 3 days at Christmas time. And I was all set to leave, and one of the other fellows asked me if I knew that my name was on the board to serve KP. And I thought, oh my gosh, I won't be able to go on the pass. But one of my fellow soldiers said that he would volunteer to take my place on KP because he didn't have anywhere to go. And he said, you can pay me back sometime. So that's the way I got away to go see my parents and my grandfather at Christmas time. Last time I saw my grandfather, he died while I was in the service. Well, anyhow, I did have a little bit of a habit of when we were marching, this drill sergeant wasn't happy because I would sort of bob up and down a little bit as I was marching. And he was always getting after me. And then he found out that they wanted a clerk typist in the battalion headquarters. And they were looking for somebody, and he wanted to get rid of me, so he volunteered me. And I went up there and helped out there with some of the typing and some of the other things there in the headquarters for a long time. And the commanding officer, battalion commanding officer, took a liking to me, and he wanted to keep me. They didn't have room for me on the position there, you know, an official position in headquarters, but he wanted to keep me in an unofficial capacity. And then the higher up above, they put out an order that they needed more troops in Europe. Mm-hmm. And commanded the 86th Infantry Division to send a lot of their troops overseas to be assigned to divisions over there. And I made the list, but the battalion commander wanted to keep me, so he got me relegated to an alternate position, which meant that the morning that the men reported all ready to go, had packs and everything they own ready to go, I was supposed to report at the same time, and if one didn't show up, then I would take his place and go. Well, fortunately for me, they all showed up, so I didn't have to go. And a lot of these young men were in training with me at Fort Benning, and we'd gotten to be pretty good friends. And I heard later on that they got over there just in time for some of the worst combat, and a lot of them were shot up and wounded and killed, and I was just really lucky that I didn't have to go. I felt a little bit guilty because I didn't have to go. And then the next thing I knew, my division wound up in California to take amphibious training. They were going to make us into an amphibious division so that we could eventually get into the Pacific War. And we trained out there in California for several months. And then the Belgian Bulge came along, and they decided that they needed more divisions in Europe because of the Belgian Bulge. So they ordered us to Europe. And we weren't supposed to go to Europe at all because we were a crack amphibious division ready to go to the Pacific. So we packed up and boarded train and crossed the United States to Boston and got on a ship and headed for France. We arrived in France and had a short period of training, and And a month after we left California, we were lining up on the Rhine River facing the Germans. And we saw quite a bit of combat in the Ruhr factory pocket that they had over there in Germany, where they made a lot of the ammunition and guns and everything else. And we captured and killed a lot of the Germans, and the Germans surrendered in the pocket. So they immediately transferred us down to Bavaria, and we went on through Bavaria and into Austria. That's where I wound up when the war in Europe ended. I was in Austria.
If I can ask you, do you remember what the first battle was like that you fought?
Well, that was just, they just called it all one battle, Central Europe, Central Germany or Central Europe. I think it was Central Europe. It must have been Central Germany. Anyhow, one of the fellows who was in the division when the war was all over, he went to college and majored in journalism, and he wrote a book about our division. And the name of the book, well, I was going to say that my division was the first division to cross the Danube River. And we were supposed to be an amphibious division. The only amphibious landing we made under fire was across the Danube River. So he wrote a book and he named it Black Hawks Over the Danube. I've got the book over here. I didn't know anything about the book, but my folks heard about it and they bought it and sent it to me. So that was the end of the war in Europe, and they didn't waste any time. They got us back to France, got us aboard ship, and they loaded us up in trucks to take us down to the ships. And on the way down, some of the French people lined up along the road and threw rocks at us. Now, I never did understand that, but that's what happened.
Why do you suppose that was?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Where were you in
maybe
France?
Maybe they threw the rocks because we were leaving. They didn't want us to leave. You can speculate about reasons. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they didn't want us over there in the first place. But anyhow, that actually happened. And we were given 30 days passes. And then we reported to Muskogee, Oklahoma, and we were completely re-outfitted because, even the clothing in the Pacific was different from Europe. In Europe, we wore wool ODs, olive drabs, and over in the Pacific, they wore tan khakis because everything was so much warmer. So we were completely outfitted, re-outfitted, and loaded on train and headed for California, and the first atomic bomb dropped, and we spent one night in California and boarded ship and headed out to sea and dropped the second atomic bomb, and before we could get to the Philippines, they signed the peace treaty with Japan. So we landed in the Philippines, and I stayed in the Philippines about 8 months. Well,
what was the Philippines like?
Well, it was a beautiful country as far as I was concerned. It reminded me a lot of Florida. But this resulted in something that's about the only significant thing about my service was that I served in both theaters. Because I got a ribbon for the ETO theater and one for the Asiatic Pacific theater. And there are very few people that I've found who served in both theaters like that. But anyhow, the atomic bomb saved my life as far as I'm concerned, because we were all set to invade Japan. That's exactly why we were rushed back from Europe. We were supposed to be in on the landing in Japan. Well, I wanted to emphasize that this really was a blow when we found out that the young fellows along with me found out that the ASTP program had been closed, and we were just going to be sent to infantry divisions and just wind up being grunts, which we were trying to avoid in the first place. But then I don't really bear a lot of bad will, because when I was discharged, I got the GI Bill, and I don't know whether I would have ever been able to afford to go to college if it hadn't been for the GI Bill. And I felt like the government paid me back after treating me dirty.
Where did you go to school?
Right here at the University of Florida.
In what field?
Accounting. And I did about as well as I expected. I joined a local firm, and we grew and grew and grew, and we developed audits all over the state. And I retired 20 years ago, and I've enjoyed my retirement, except I've had some health problems that I wish I hadn't had. But I'm a member of the Grand Guard of the university. You know, that's 50 years after you graduate. Been 59 years now. My wife and I have left bequests in our wills for the University Foundation. So that puts us on the President's Council, because we did it soon enough. It takes a lot more money now to do that, but we were one of the first ones.
Could I ask you some particular questions about, sure, about the war?
I wound up with a combat infantryman badge, which you get for combat fire, combat experience. But before that, they had what was an expert infantryman badge, and they still have it. It's a badge that you get for 24-hour endurance test. That's the way it was back then. You spent 24 hours going from one station to another and passing all these different tests. Like you would come to a wall, and you'd climb over the wall, and there would be an artificial soldier right behind the wall with a bayonet, and you had to thrust your bayonet at that artificial soldier, and there would be a sergeant there watching to see that you did it right, you know. And if you did it wrong, then you failed. It just sends you home. One test. But now they've rearranged it. I understand you're allowed to try it again, or if you get three failures, you're sent home. But in order to take the test, you've got to meet certain requirements. You've got to have completed 1 mile march with field pack in 50 minutes, 2 miles in 2 hours or less, I forget what. You had to have complete a 25-mile march. And then you had to pass be expert with the weapon that was your weapon. And you had to have gone through the bayonet assault course and the infiltration course, which where they fired live bullets over you, and you had to crawl down low enough to keep from being hit by the bullets, the obstacle course and first aid courses and all that sort of thing. And these stations, see, were based on those requirements. One station would be there was a wounded soldier, and you had to treat him properly, and then they had a test where you walked along a trail, and these artificial German soldiers would pop up, and you had to fire at each one. If you missed firing at one, you know, didn't see him, but then he might fail to go any further. And several different tests. And then they had a day compass course. Compass course meant that you were supposed to go so many yards in one direction based on your compass reading, and then so many yards in another direction, and then so many yards in about three or four different twists and turns, and come out on a particular target. So I passed that all right. And the very last test, see, was a night compass course. And you had to do the same thing, you know, so many yards one direction and so many yards another direction. And when I completed my azimuth, they call it, and I was supposed to come out at the particular spot, where I came out, there wasn't anybody there, but I looked over here, I'd say about 50 yards or so, and I saw a dim light. And so I thought, well, I'll just walk over there and see where I am. And so I went over there, and it turned out that was the spot of where I was supposed to come out. So they said, you passed. So I got the expert badge, which I still have. And at that time, you got $5 more per month for that. And the combat badge, you got $10 more per month. And you couldn't get both at the same time. So I collected my $5 one month, and then the next month, I had the combat badge. And also, I received a Bronze Star.
What did you receive the Bronze Star for?
I can't remember exactly what the certificate says. Something, you know, some flowery. I got it in there. I can show it to you.
Recognition for service.
Well, recognition for something more than service. Combat service, or extra—I think it's something about extraordinary service under in combat, or something like that.
When you were first deployed in Europe, did you feel prepared for battle?
Yeah, I thought I was ready to go. We'd had good training. There was a story I like to tell is on the ship on the way over there to Germany, to France. We had this fellow who was almost too old to be drafted. He was married and had a couple of children. And he kept saying all the way over there, he just knew he wasn't coming back. Something just told him he wouldn't make it back. And, of course, we kept telling him, oh, don't talk like that. So we got on over there, and after a little bit of training in France, and we were trucked on up to Germany to get to the front line, and we were loaded on other trucks and headed up toward the front line, and we started receiving artillery shells all around us, so we all jumped out of the truck and headed for the ditch. And he was in the ditch right beside me, and I looked down, and he had all this blood running down his leg. So we all started yelling for the medic, and the medic came and put him on a stretcher and carried him away. And we never saw him again, but we got a letter from him. He was in the hospital in Paris. After 1 second of combat, he received a combat infantry badge, Purple Heart, Bronze Star, ETO ribbon, and was being sent home. I think that was a pretty good story.
Ben's happy. did you have enough supplies, and what was the quality of equipment?
Yeah, we had plenty of supplies. We had good food all the time too. We had good cooks. And they always were able to bring us up something good to eat. Most of the time, a hot meal.
What sorts of things did you eat?
Oh, I don't remember now.
Were there any particularly humorous or unusual events?
Well, the one I just told I thought was humorous. Well, I could tell another one. I didn't keep up my contact with any of my fellow soldiers, except one who lives in Indiana. And we were ordered to dig foxholes, two-man foxholes, because we expected a big run of tanks, German tanks. So he and I dug a good foxhole, and we made it plenty deep to where a tank could run over the top, you know, without hitting our heads. And we put a little seat on each end of it, so we got all ready to spend the night. And during the night, we kept hearing a scratching noise. It sounded like some animal was scratching inside under the walls of the foxhole, but we never did know what it was. But I told him I thought I was going to get up out of the foxhole and just stretch a little bit. And so I stood up above the foxhole, and about that time this German soldier came up, and I think he wanted to surrender, but I pulled out my pistol and held it on him, and I escorted him on to the battalion headquarters and turned him over to them. And so I guess I should have taken credit for capturing one of the Germans. Oh, another humorous story I can tell is when the Ruhr pocket was all over, and we were put on trucks to be carried overnight down to Bavaria, and we were going to be assigned to Patton's army, and we were in the trucks on the way down there, and it was at night. And we were strafed by an airplane, and of course, there again, we all jumped out of the truck, and this fella, he was a Jewish boy named Biscue. He was the kind of a person where he was always trying to promote himself, you know, and get credit for something. And when he jumped out of the truck, he hit his chin on a rock. So he applied for the Purple Heart, and they wouldn't give it to him. We all laughed at him. We didn't think he deserved it.
Did you carry anything special for good luck?
No.
No.
Don't remember that I did.
What were your interactions with the locals like?
Well, I enjoyed talking to them. I picked up a lot of German. The only language I ever studied was in high school. I had 2.5 years of Spanish, and I don't think I could say a dozen words of Spanish, but I learned a lot of German just by fraternizing with the people over there. Of course, I didn't learn anything about conjugation and writing correct German, and that sort of thing. And I could tell a funny story that happened later, after the war was all over. My wife and I went over there. Our daughter was married to a fellow in the army, and we went over to visit them, her and her husband, and we wanted to rent a car and go see some of the places where I had been to see if I could recognize anything where I'd been. And so my daughter drove us in her, she had a little van, and she drove us downtown. I had called the Avis rental agency to rent a car and had it all reserved and everything. They told me that the agency was near the railroad station in downtown Wiesbaden. So we rode round and round the railroad station two or three times, and we never did see any Avis sign. So I said, well, just let me out, and I'll go in the railroad station. I'll ask some questions. I'll find it, and when I find it, I'll just drive the car on out to where you're staying. So I got out, and I went in the railroad station, and I had this brochure, you know, about Avis Rentals. And I went up to this clerk's cage, and I said, voice Avis, Nix Fristane. So I showed her the little pamphlet, and she said, she just pointed down this tunnel. There's a tunnel that went down under the street and came up on the other side of the block. So I went down that tunnel and came up over there, and I didn't see any Avis sign. And I started walking on down this sidewalk, and I ran into this elderly gentleman. He was all dressed up in a suit, and I stopped him. I said, voice Avis, Nix Fristane, Avis. He said, oh, yeah, Avis, yeah. So then he motioned me, and he led me to where I could see the sign. So I learned over there, it's not Avis, it's Avis.
Did you keep a diary or take photographs?
I wrote a lot of letters home. I'm glad you asked about that. I wrote a lot of letters home, and my father kept every letter and bound them up in notebooks. And I've still got all those letters, and I don't know what to do with them. I'm still trying to decide. I belong to the local VFW post. I hold an office there. I'm the adjutant general. And I was thinking about just donating those letters to the post. Also, I've got my old Eisenhower jacket, battle jacket, they call it, with my ribbons and everything on it. After I was discharged, when I came here to the university, I took advanced ROTC and got a commission, and so I was in the reserve for, I think it was about six years or so, and I was assigned to a unit in Orlando, and it was a company of a battalion that was part of the 101st Airborne Division. They were, you know, they had been sent home, and they were now in reserve. So I was in Company B of whatever battalion this was, and that was the Screaming Eagle Parachute Division, you know. And I was in a glider battalion, but I never did do anything, never did. They kept trying to get me to go to jump school, and I wouldn't go. So anyhow, I came up here to Gainesville, and Company A was here in Gainesville of the same battalion, and they had just been sent to Korea. So when I got up here, they didn't have any infantry unit to assign me to. I was just at large, or replacement soldier, so to speak. But then after I'd been up here a little while, they sent Company B over to Korea. So if I had stayed down there a few more days, I would have been sent to Korea. And if I'd come up here a little earlier, I would have been sent to Korea. So that's how close I came to be in Korea. And I never tried to get any higher than first lieutenant in the reserve. knew a lot of men who stayed in the reserves, and they kept getting promotions till they wound up as majors and colonels and so forth. And I could have done the same thing. And they kept notifying me that I had to go to summer camp. They couldn't promote me unless I'd go to summer camp for 2 weeks. And I didn't want to go off and leave my wife and kids. I wanted to use the 2 weeks for vacations with them. So I just always refused to go. And they finally notified me that I had to either go to summer camp and be promoted or resign my commission because I was over 18 grade. So I resigned.
Did you suffer from fatigue or stress as a result of combat?
Well, yeah. I remember when the war ended, I was asleep. I was just dead tired and just worn out. We just stayed awake so much. It was the main thing, just staying on the move and didn't have any chance to sleep. And somebody came and shook me and said, the war is over. And I said, good, and went right back to sleep. I had just celebrated my 20th birthday, drafted at age 18, and 20 years old in the German war, and I was still 20 years old when I was discharged. I took my discharge in California. My dad had a first cousin there in California, and I went to see him and his wife, and they had a good-looking daughter, so I invited her to go out with me one night, and we went to they lived in Los Angeles, and we went to the club Copacabana, and the waiter came around and wanted to know what we'd like to have to drink, and I said, well, something, I don't remember, probably bourbon and ginger ale or something, and then he looked at her and he said, well, I know you're not old enough. And he said, you'll have to show me. He looked at me and said, you'll have to show me your ID. Well, I was going to be 21 the next day. And he wouldn't serve me a drink. And all the time I was in the Army, see, Alexandria, Louisiana, and all these places in California, San Luis Obispo, San Diego, we didn't have any trouble getting a drink. Nobody ever asked us what our age was or anything because we were in uniform. But then when I took my cousin out, I had just bought some civilian clothes and I was dressed as a civilian, so that made a big difference, I found out.
Did you go on leave, and what did you do on leave?
Well, I was on leave several times. When I went to Louisiana to join the 86th Infantry Division, my time came up shortly after for furlough, so I went back home. I think I had a 10-day furlough. Went back to Orlando, and about the only thing I can remember is I had dated a lot of girls while I was there, and then later on I became eligible for another furlough, and so as luck would have it, while I was on furlough, the division would be transferring to California. So I went home, went to Orlando, and when my time was up, I boarded a private train, I mean, you know, a regular passenger train, and traveled by train all the way to California to rejoin my outfit. And that was a real experience. Then when we came home from Europe, as I said a while ago, we had 30-day furloughs and then reported to Oklahoma for a re-outfit and retraining and so forth. We were supposed to stay 6 weeks there, I believe, and it seemed like we only stayed about 2 weeks before they got us on a train headed for California and the Pacific.
What are your memories of VJ Day?
I'm not sure what was VJ Day. I guess when they signed the treaty with Japan, and if that's when it was, I was on board ship headed for the Philippines. We heard that they had signed the peace treaty. I guess that's the day they celebrate, as VJ Day. I'm not positive. Just glad to have it over with. Glad the war was over when it ended in Europe, and then we were glad that it ended in Japan. All of us believed that the atomic bomb saved our lives. They estimated that there would be 1 million casualties in an invasion of Japan, either casualties or deaths, I forget which.
Did you maintain contact with those you met during the war?
Very, very little. Just like I said, this one fella who lives in Indiana, I just talked to him on the phone the other day. He has Parkinson's. And it was difficult for him to talk. I maintained contact with another fellow who, he went to the Philippines with us, and the Army came out with a special deal that you could re-enlist for a year and choose the theater where you wanted to serve. And he decided he would re-enlist for a year, and he wanted to go back to France. He spoke French fluently. He was descended from French parents, so he re-enlisted and left us and went to Europe. And I got letters from him several times, and the last letter I received was that he was in the counterintelligence corps, and he was to be addressed as Mr. from then on. He wasn't supposed, had been promoted to, I think, major, but he wasn't supposed to be addressed by that title. He just addressed letters to him as Mr. So I heard from him about one more time, and he wrote to him a couple of times, and never heard from him again. And I've always figured, you know, that he must have been killed or something, but he was quite a ladies' man and told a lot about some of his escapades with the women over there, and that was one reason he wanted to go back to France. And I thought that some jealous husband might have killed him. I don't know. I never did know. I did have another friend. I said a while ago I was discharged in California. I had to have some reason as to why I didn't want to come back to Orlando, where I was drafted. And I told them I was thinking about going to work out there and just living in California. So they accepted that and discharged me there, paid me a nickel a mile all the way home instead of bringing me home. So I had this real good friend. It took us 23 days to get home from the Philippines by ship. And he and I talked a lot on board the ship, and we decided that when we got our discharge, we were going to go to San Francisco, and we were going to go to a barber shop and get a haircut and a shampoo and pedicure and manicure and get all the Army dirt out of us. And then we were going to go to the top of the Mark Hopkins Hotel. I don't know whether you ever heard of it or not, but it's a very famous hotel. It's still there. And we were going to have dinner and have some drinks. And so we did all the things, but we found out the Top of the Mark was no longer serving meals. They just had a cocktail lounge, and so we went to another restaurant called Monaco's. But anyhow, when I came on back to Florida, we sent Christmas cards back and forth to each other, maintained contact for several years, and me and one of his Christmas cards, he had gone into medical school and had become a physician and ear, nose, and throat specialist. And then the next Christmas, I didn't hear from him. And I didn't hear from him the next Christmas and the next Christmas. And I thought, well, I guess he's just making so much money and so busy being a doctor now, he doesn't have time for me anymore. So my wife and I went out to California. I had a convention in San Francisco. And this friend's home was in Los Angeles, and I forgot to say that I spent a couple of nights in his home when we went from San Francisco down to Los Angeles. So Faye and I, my wife and I, went out there on our 25th wedding anniversary, and we attended the convention in San Francisco, and then we rented a car and drove on down the coast of California. And I showed her all the places where I had been during training. And when we got to Los Angeles, we spent a night in the Holiday Inn. And I looked in the telephone directory to see if I could find my friend's name. Thought, you know, I looked under physicians and everywhere else. And his name was a funny name, Waka. He was Czechoslovakian descent. W-A-C-H-A, Waka. And there was only one Waka listed in the telephone directory. So I called that number, and this man answered the phone, and I told him I was trying to find my friend. And he said, he wanted to know a little bit about who I was and why and so forth. And then he said, well, I'm your friend's uncle. And he said he died several years ago. That he was sitting in front of the TV, watching TV, and just all of a sudden had a heart attack and died. So I was real sorry to hear that. And he said another thing sad was that his wife already had cancer, and she didn't live much longer, and she died. So that's why there were no walkers in the telephone directory except this one. So that was probably the closest contact I had, other than this fellow who lives in Indiana. We call each other foxhole buddies.
Were you part of any celebrations or parades upon your return?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, see, we were one of the first divisions to be returned from Europe when the war was over there. And we had landed in New York Harbor, my first glimpse of the Statue of Liberty. And that was just an amazing experience. And I was met by the publisher of the Orlando Sentinel newspaper. They had decided that the first soldiers to come home, they were going to meet them and embed with them. They call it embedding now. They just live with them until they got home and report every move they made. So I had all kinds of publicity, all in the Orlando Sentinel.
Did you keep the news clippings?
No, I don't know why. I don't seem to have them in with the letters that my dad saved. When I went to my 50th high school reunion, they had some headlines of the war ending and everything, and I looked in there to see if there's anything. I remember distinctly there was one headline. See, my name was known as Johnny, in Orlando. And there was one headline across the one page of the paper, Johnny Comes Home, based on the song, you know. But I don't know what happened to that headline. It was not in this scrapbook in the museum there in Orlando.
Well, Mr. Knight, I'd like to thank you for your time and for sharing your memories.
Well, I hope we've covered everything. I didn't try to keep any notes or anything. I've got these letters that I wrote home. I've got this book about the division I served in.